It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about the sweeping domestic policy package now, the Inflation Reduction Act signed into law Tuesday, what it means for the IRS, what it means for your taxes. It provides roughly $80 billion in additional funding to the IRS over the decade, will allow the agency to hire up thousands of agents, revamp its technology. Join in on what's ahead for the agency, tax law changes, repercussions, closing the tax gap, recovering what Americans owe but don't pay. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Samantha Jacoby is here, Senior Tax Legal Analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Samantha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, with this $80 billion, give or take there, what do you know, what information has surfaced on how this money will be used?
Yeah, so I think first, it's important to take a step back to look at what's happened to the IRS over the last decade or so. Its budget has been cut by 20% since 2010 after adjusting for inflation, and its staff has been cut by about a fifth, with even larger cuts in the enforcement function of the agency. And so the audit rates of all groups have declined, but especially for millionaires and the largest corporations. So what this bill does is it provides $80 billion over a long period of time, over 10 years, that'll help the IRS to rebuild after those devastating cuts. So it will allow the agency to hire and train new workers over the course of several years, as well as to invest in new technology. And I think just as an example why that's important, the agency's software, some of it dates back all the way to the 1960s. Mm-hmm. People who know how to program that software are all retiring. So it's really important that the agency be able to put in new technology, a new workforce that allows it to better combat tax evasion and to better serve people. Right now, only a few phone calls can even get answered. 7 out of 10 phone calls don't even get answered by the IRS. So in important ways, this will actually help a lot of people to be able to get their questions answered and better file their tax returns.
I was looking at the Congressional Budget Office cost estimate from earlier this month that says investing this money in the IRS over a decade, it'll collect $204 billion in gross revenue and $123 billion in net revenue. So that's, I would imagine, some serious return on investment if all goes as planned. How confident should we be in those types of estimates?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. There's actually pretty widespread agreement among budget estimators that each dollar that you invest in the IRS returns multiple dollars back to the federal government in revenue. And the CBO estimate is actually somewhat conservative. Treasury had estimated, based on a similar investment of $80 billion, that there would actually be a $400 billion net revenue because of differences in what they were counting. Essentially, Treasury was counting indirect effects of deterrence, whereas CBO didn't, things like that. Hmm. So I think I think people are pretty confident that there's a high return on investment from IRS enforcement investment, and that the CBO's estimate is more likely on the low end.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how the Inflation Reduction Act that was signed into law Tuesday, how it might affect our country's economy and tax system, and what this overhaul of the IRS could mean. And we have Samantha Jacoby, who's a senior analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can weigh in on this, 800-642-1234. Samantha, you've talked about how the IRS has been so gutted and lack of a budget. How much could the workforce of tax agents grow from previous levels with this funding?
Yeah, so I think there's been some Anyway, yeah.
87,000? Would you like to start there?
So I'll just say that number is not the number of revenue agents that will be hired. There was a Treasury put out a document about a year or so ago that estimated that with this kind of investment, that's the number of employees, full-time equivalent employees, that they would hire over the course of the 10 years in aggregate. That's not just enforcement, right? There's also, I mentioned, a huge need for technology. That's going to be IT people, people building out the tech function, as well as people answering the phones, people processing the backlog of unprocessed returns. In addition to more enforcement employees, but it could also account for retiring employees. We don't have a specific number of, you know, the number of people that are going to be out auditing returns yet, but the Treasury Secretary this week did call for the IRS to put out a plan for how they're going to spend the money. So we'll likely see that in the coming months.
I was looking at that $25 billion would be allocated to support IRS operations like rent payments, printing, postage, mm-hmm. telecommunications. Is that like just the infrastructure of doing business as an agency?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, operations is office support, utilities, like keeping the lights on, things like that. It supports all aspects of the agency's function.
Makes me wonder what happens after the $80 billion is exhausted in a decade. How do you maintain those resources you've added and fine-tuned?
Yeah, so there still would be annual appropriations, just like all agencies use every year. So the base funding of the agency would continue to be dependent on the annual appropriations process. The $80 billion is meant to sort of rebuild after the decade of cuts.
How much uncollected taxes is the IRS typically missing without the proper funding? What is this tax gap?
Yeah, so the tax gap refers to the amount of tax that is legally owed each year that is not paid on time and that the IRS does not collect through enforcement. So the estimate for the current tax gap is around $600 billion each year of taxes that people should be paying, but they're not. And, you know, a lot of it is intentional and a lot of it may be accidental, but in any case, it should be paid and isn't. And when taxes aren't paid, the people who are paying their taxes bear the brunt of it. And when you look at the revenue that is expected to be raised from the IRS investment, that $124 billion net revenue, that's over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And a $600 billion annual tax gap, right? So that's only plugging a small hole in that tax gap. There's still more to do.
Has the tax gap widened or stayed the same over the decades? What do you see?
Yeah, so the IRS only estimates the tax gap every few years, and the data that they use is always lagged by a few years because of data availability issues, statute of limitations and audits, stuff like that. So the last official tax gap estimate they did was from 2011 to 2013 data, and it was around $330 billion, and the estimate for today is based on growth of the economy and additional variables. So it's now $600 billion. And if you project outward, it's expected to grow even more. So it looks like it may be getting bigger. And when you account for the depleting budget of the IRS, it's reasonable to assume that those who are tax evaders are trying to take advantage of that even more.
We have senior tax legal analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Samantha Jacoby is here with us on the Inflation Reduction Act, now law, what it means for the IRS and taxation in our country. Join in on IRS enforcement, the future of audits, the 15% corporate minimum tax, and more. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The head of the IRS says the funding in the Inflation Reduction Act marks a transformational moment for the agency. But what will the impact be when filling out your next tax return? It's $80 billion over a decade, much of that directed at tax enforcement. Join in on the future of the IRS, tax law changes, this funding infusion, 800-642-1234. Samantha Jacoby is a senior tax legal analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, stays with us. Samantha, you know, we've heard Janet Yellen say that the new enforcement resources will focus on high-end non-compliance. But what about middle-class families, lower-class workers? Will they, too, be more likely to face an audit with a fully funded IRS?
So, you know, I think it's important to just to look at what we're talking about here. So most people... They get most of their income from wages or salaries, and you know their taxes are automatically withheld by their employers. On the other hand, you know, most high income people, they get a lot of their income from more opaque sources like capital gains or from owning businesses, and it's much harder to audit those kinds of returns. And so the people who tend to get their income from wages and salaries, their rates of compliance are very high, 99%. So the increased resources for IRS auditing will really help the IRS to look at those more complex returns, because they just can't, they don't have the resources to do it. But that's where the bulk of the tax gap really is. 28% of the tax gap is from those high income people. So for most people, the actual impact of increased resources for the IRS won't be increased audit chances. The Treasury Secretary has actually directed the IRS not to increase audit rates for people making under $400,000 a year compared to historical levels. But what it will let the IRS do is to increase audit rates for those sort of higher income, opaque income sources that really going to get at what the tax gap is hitting.
But who will watch how exactly the IRS will decide how to ramp up audits? I mean, who watches the IRS, because they have to ultimately decide who they're going to go after?
Yeah, so the IRS actually is subject to a great deal of oversight. There's an inspector general that conducts different audits of the IRS, as well as the GAO. Members of Congress can request the GAO do look at whether the IRS is complying with what they said they were going to do. Congress can also bring in the IRS commissioner to testify, and required they provide information to Congress. And I expect that will happen a great deal over the next few years.
Government Accountability Office there as well in the mix. Well, let's turn to a question here. Allison from La Crosse sent us an email, and Allison is wondering how the IRS plans to recruit additional workers given the current labor shortages in our economy.
Yeah, that's a good question. They've been sort of struggling with that as well during the pandemic. And I think they're with the funding, hopefully they'll just be able to find workers who can do the job. I think that's a good question, something to look toward. I think one point there is, because it's 10-year funding, a lot of the hiring will take place in future years. I referenced earlier a Treasury document that they project to hire thousands of workers over the next 10 years, but only about 5,000 were in the first year. So they'll ramp up the hiring over several years. It won't all happen at once.
At once. Well, let's talk about your bread and butter tax law here. So it created a 15% minimum tax for corporations. What will this do?
Yeah, so this tax, first, it's the biggest new or the biggest tax increase in the bill. It would raise around $220 billion over 10 years. And it only applies to some of the very biggest corporations, those that have $1 billion in profits each year. And what it does is it adds a new 15% minimum tax, sort of an alternative minimum tax on the income that these corporations report to shareholders. So they'll either pay the regular corporate tax or this 15% minimum tax, whichever is higher. And what it does is it ensures that these really, really big corporations, that they have to pay some minimum level of tax every year and that they can't reduce their tax to zero by claiming various tax breaks or shifting profits to overseas tax havens, which is something that we've seen from some of the biggest corporations in the past.
But if the current corporate tax rate is 21%, from due to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, how does this 15% work?
Yeah, so it's if you look at the 21% corporate tax that exists today, that still lets companies take lots of different tax breaks, deductions, credits. They can shift profits to tax havens, and so they're paying 21% of a smaller base, and this is a 15% tax on a wider base. So it's basically a smaller rate, broader base, and whichever one's greater, they pay.
Talking about the budgetary impacts of the Inflation Reduction Act with Samantha Jacoby, Senior Analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can join in 800-642-1234. Samantha, Democrats failed to close the carried interest loophole with this law. Can you explain what this loophole is?
Yeah, that was one of the disappointing things. So the carried interest loophole, it gets talked about a lot. It refers to the way private equity fund managers get paid. So we're talking about some of the richest people in the country, the people who run funds like Blackstone, KKR, Carlyle Group. The way they make their money is by buying and selling distressed companies. And instead of a salary, those fund managers get paid as a share of the fund's profits. And because of that, they're taxed at a 20% capital gains rate, which is a little around half the top rate on salaries. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, big tax break. And there's not really an economic rationale for that treatment. And both Republicans and Democrats have called to end the loophole.
I'm sorry to jump in here. Let's bring in a caller, Tom in Madison. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think the very first thing the IRS needs to do is to set up a secure IRS site for tax filing, reporting, and payments. And get out of the business with these unholy alliance partners of the software developers who we have to pay to file our taxes.
Tom, thank you for that. Go ahead, Samantha.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point and something that the IRS will be looking into whether they can do that in the coming years. The money that they are getting will help them to rebuild their technology to potentially allow for that to happen. And it is a big problem. There's a lot of evidence that paid preparers, they have higher inaccuracy rates and contribute to issues with tax filing. So that's a good point and something that the IRS will be looking into in the coming years.
So as this law takes hold, what will you be watching for in the coming years?
Well, I think certainly implementation of IRS funding is an important thing to look out for. The Treasury will also be implementing the corporate minimum tax by writing regulations for how companies are going to comply with it. I think another important thing is the Trump tax cuts from 2017 are going to be, some of them are expiring in a few years. And so I think there's more tax work to be done in the coming years, and that's what I'll be looking at.
Samantha, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good day.
You too, Samantha Jacoby, Senior Tax Legal Analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Ahead this hour, we'll look at how researchers are using remote-controlled watercraft to study fish populations in the Great Lakes. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reading to children.
A mother's voice can wrap us in warm blankets. It can guide gently or yank us back from the cliff. And sometimes it can take us places we only dreamed were possible. Jan Larson and her three grown children remember a mother's voice.
Our children are grown. The magic is packed in cardboard boxes and tucked away in the loft, waiting for the next generation to reveal its secrets. The snuggler, an oversized chair that once cradled the Larsons five each night before sleep claimed our three young ones, sits empty in the corner of our living room. But once upon a time, those twilight hours held the promise of adventure, of magic, of silly laughter, as my husband and I beckoned our pajama-clad pirates to join us in the joy of reading. And when the clamor for, "Just one more, Mommy," rang out, I didn't mind a bit.
Dina, what do you remember about being read to as a child?
You did voices. And now whenever I read to friends or loved ones, I do voices. And it makes all the difference. It's even more immersive. And it's funny because just like I associate certain characters in some of my favorite stories from my childhood with you, some of the favorite characters in stories that I've shared with friends or loved ones since then are now associated with my voice and my mannerisms.
Gray, what are you thinking about? How did reading make you feel?
I just wanted to speak to what Dana said because Dana and I read together, and I read sometimes. But most often, I like when Dana reads because he's better at the voices.
Ellie, what do you remember about the Larsons Five reading together at night?
We were living on our sailboat together and found a copy of the seventh Harry Potter book. And by that time, two of us were teenagers already, but we still loved having you read to us. And we made you read that book for hours on end because we were so desperate to hear more of this story and couldn't get our hands on enough copies for all of us to have separately. And I remember you begging us to let you take a break so that you could get food and some water.
Yes, I remember that very well. And then what did you do that night after I'd gone to bed? Because I went to bed with the book and hid it under my pillow.
Well, your point was to make it fair so that nobody could read ahead, but I snuck it out from under your pillow and stayed up all night reading it.
I distinctly remember being at the end of a chain of theft. Ellie would steal the book from Mom and read it, and then Gray would procure the book from Ellie and read it, and the whole time that they were reading it would be pouting at them disapprovingly, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading ahead, okay? This is for Mom to read."
What he meant was we weren't supposed to be reading ahead of Dana.
Yeah, not without me.
Do you think ahead to maybe having your own families and what you'll do then?
Yes, bring them over so that you can read to them too.
I'll be happy to. I will be happy to. And then it will be a grandmother's voice. That will be a fun thing.
Well, you're going to have to wait a while for that. That's not coming anytime soon.
That's okay. That'll be worth the wait. Thanks so much. It is always a pleasure to get to read to you, and I hope that you have good memories of feeling warm and loved.
We always do.
They're all of the best memories.
You gave us all the good things that we have.
Oh, I love you, kids.
Love you, Mom.
We love you, Mom.
Aren't you going to say your signature line?
Oh. Thanks for making us.
And they all lived happily in harmony and peace ever after.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to a pair of remote-controlled sail drones launched on Lake Superior, gathering fish data around the clock. Picture one long single hull, bright orange, with this tall, hard wing jutting up from its center with a spar running lengthwise. And they're powered by wind and solar, made by a California firm called Sail Drone. And it's the first use of them on Lake Superior. Join in on fish surveys and these uncrewed vessels, 800-642-1234. Peter Esselman is a research fishery biologist at the U.S. Geological Survey and primary investigator for a three-year study of fish populations in the Great Lakes using uncrewed sailing vessels and autonomous underwater vehicles. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning.
So, good morning. You launched them near the Apostle Islands last week. Where are they now?
The two sail drones have went west for a while around the Apostles and towards Duluth, and then they crossed the lake to the north, and now they're on the north shore of Lake Superior in Minnesota waters.
Okay, so now they're at our neighbor's side.
That's correct. But they'll be zigzagging through the western arm of Lake Superior, and eventually will enter Canadian waters and then cross south around Isle Royale and then back home to Ashland.
I gave my best shot at describing what they look like. Do you have any ways that you like to depict them or describe them?
They're basically large orange sailboats that are remotely helmed. So there's someone at a base station in California that is monitoring their progress and issuing routes and commands to them. It's basically a rigid sailboat that's covered with solar panels.
Hmm. I would imagine you'd be like a kid in a candy store flooded with all this new data and, you know, so much of it. Can you explain what information you're gathering here about Lake Superior?
Absolutely. So I'll give you a little bit of background. So the Great Lakes commercial and recreational fishery is extremely valuable to coastal communities and really to all the Great Lakes states. Fishery Commission has estimated that the Great Lakes economy generates $7 billion per year just from the lakes alone and provides over 75,000 jobs. The fishery is actively managed by the Great Lakes Council of Lake Committees, which is basically a group made up of the states, the tribes, and the province of Ontario, and it's also convened by a group called the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. So every year, these lake committees on each lake make decisions about quotas and seasons and catch limits and size limits, and they use data to support their decision making. And USGS is one of the organizations, the longest running organization, providing data to support those decisions. So typically, we do our work with large research vessels. We tow nets through the water, and we use scientific echo sounders, which are basically powerful fish finders. And the quality of the data that we provide to the lake managers essentially affects the quality of their decisions they can make downstream. So if our estimates are low, it's possible that the quotas they set will be low. So the study that we're carrying out with these advanced survey technologies that are essentially being brought here from ocean environments, the purpose of the study is really to evaluate the accuracy of the estimates of fish abundances that we're providing to our management partners. In comparing the data that come from these new instruments to our conventional large vessel surveys.
So as you said there, these were designed for long range ocean science missions. Do you find this new technology compatible to lake missions, or are there some necessary adjustments that you need to make?
These technologies are extremely compatible to the Great Lakes. These are inland seas more than they're considered lakes, in my opinion. You know, the sail drone is a technology that can go out for months at a time, and so it offers us the potential in the future, you know, to essentially collect data 24/7 from ice off to ice on. And then there's other technologies that we're using to also assess fisheries and try to get a better handle on how accurate our numbers are.
So as this technology is being used until, is it end of September? Is it when they finish up their run?
Yeah, this mission will be through the end of the first week of September.
Okay, and then are the traditional trawling boats collecting fish data at the same time?
That's correct. So we've been able to work very closely with the states of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin, the Red Cliff Band and the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa Indians, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the province of Ontario, to get six different research vessels on the water at the same time to collect comparative data in the same water on the same night as these silenced fisheries data collection vehicles. And the idea is that what we're doing is we're comparing echo sounder based estimates of fish abundance that are coming from a platform, these sail drones, that is completely silent, to the numbers that are coming from vessels that produce noise and potentially scare fish away from the location where we're doing our census work. So in working with our partners, we're going to amass a large data set that will help us understand to what extent noise affects our abundances, whether noise, for instance, leads to lower abundance estimates, which, as I mentioned earlier, might have some downstream impacts on decision making.
Do you know at all how noise affects fish? I mean, going into this comparison contrast type of experiment, what do you know about noise?
Sure. So there's been a number of studies around the world. This is a topic that's been studied more extensively in an ocean environment. And it's clear from the literature that in many cases, fish do avoid noise propagated from large research vessels in the upper part of the water column. And they tend to flee away and down from the location of the noise production, i.e. the, you know, in our case, twin diesel engines on our 107-foot research vessel, Kaiai. There's another source of bias that isn't directly related to noise, which is that our echo sounders are deployed about 15 feet down into the water, basically at the bottom of the vessel. And so whatever fish are occurring in the upper water column are also missed. And there's been two powerful studies in the Great Lakes, including one in Lake Superior, showing that by not accounting for fish at the water surface, you end up coming up with 2 to 3 times low estimates of how many fish are actually in the water. And so in addition to these sail drones, we've embraced a technology that was developed by the Monterey Aquarium Research Institute. And this is a midwater, like an underwater autonomous vehicle that has uplooking fish finders that essentially allows us to count fish at the surface. And so we're also comparing our data from vessels to these uplooking echo sounders in these long range autonomous underwater vehicles. So we just completed a 2-week mission with one of those, and that autonomous underwater vehicle is now moving to Lake Michigan.
This is like no fish left behind.
I mean, that's certainly what the trend seems to be. These technologies really give us a order of magnitude greater information. It's sort of entering the big data era here.
Mm, USGS research fishery biologist Peter Esselman with us, lead scientist on this 3-year study with sail drone fish population data collection, comparing it to how they're collecting this data now. Join in on Acoustic Echo Fish Finders, your observations about the Lake Superior fish population, curiosities about the sail drone technology and how it works, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could join us. We are exploring this pair of uncrewed sail drones that have set sail in Lake Superior near the Apostle Islands and what these boats may tell scientists about the accuracy of understanding the Great Lakes fish population. Join in on the science of counting fish in the Great Lakes, what this technology will do for scientists, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have USGS research fishery biologist and project lead Peter Esselman, who stays with us. So, Peter, they have this onboard computer so that they can navigate the waypoints. So how do the sail drones handle extreme weather, and what happens if they're caught in a storm?
So sail drone has protocols for dealing with extreme weather. One of those is to essentially let the sail, the rigid sail, go limp. And essentially, it'll avoid tipping over and damage. It's essentially, at that point, it becomes a floating buoy. Sail Drone is a company that has actually recently gained accolades for sending a slightly modified version of the drone that we have out into the eye of a Category 4 hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. And so these are very robust science instruments, and they're not very prone to, tipping or capsizing.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's bring on a caller now. Emily is with us from Milwaukee. Emily, hi.
Good morning. I just had a question about how this guest thinks or anticipates this data is used, and specifically whether you view your job or collecting the data as more in the service of conservation interests or more in the interest of recreational fishing? And kind of relatedly, do you think the danger is greater that you are going to over or underestimate the number of fish with this technology?
Great questions, Emily. The diverging interests there. Go ahead, Peter.
Absolutely. So the fisheries management community is concerned certainly with maximizing the benefit of the fishery to the public. And but there's also a large concern with restoring native species, and there's been a concerted 50-year effort at, for instance, restoring lake trout populations, which are native to the Great Lakes. And there's also an ongoing startup effort to restore lake herring and other species related to them into the lower Great Lakes below Lake Superior. And so, USGS as a science organization is really responding to the needs of our partners for data. And the need that they've identified is to understand how many prey fish are out there in the lake, prey fish being kind of the bait that support the predator stocks. I believe that there's a chance, especially with the uplooking echo sounder, we will see slightly increased estimates of abundance and maybe even drastically increased estimates of abundance. Our data sets currently span 44 years in Lake Superior, 48, 49 years in Lake Michigan, and they're consistent internally because we've used the same methods the whole time. But all gear types have biases, and the biases that we're trying to control this summer are likely to give us higher estimates of abundance.
So, with those higher estimates of abundance, you can take that really good data and put it to use in a commercial aspect for fishing, but also in a conservation aspect. How could those two different interests both be fueled by this data?
Absolutely. So yeah, so let me give you a concrete example. So the Lake Superior Committee sets quotas for harvest of lake herring, which is fished for its roe. This is also called Cisco in Lake Superior. And essentially, they use our estimates of abundance and other data streams coming from the states and the tribes to consider a sustainable harvest levels. And so, you know, in that case, you can see it as focused on both sustainability, which is a conservation concept that's important, but also on harvest and sustaining an economy around that fishery. There's a similar effort for lake trout harvest. For instance, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources considers our data to set quotas for harvest and also bag limits, which essentially define the number of fish and the size of the fish that can be taken by anglers. And so, you know, in every case, my observation is that the lake committees that are setting these targets are considering the long-term sustainability of the fishery, not so much just maximizing profit. Of course, there's always pressure to allow more fishing and higher quotas, but my observation is that sustainability is a central concept to what the managers are doing with the data we provide them.
Talking with USGS research fishery biologist Peter Esselman. Going to John now in Boaz with a question. John, hi.
Good morning. I was wondering if your database has a category for Asian carp, and how are they doing?
Peter, go ahead on Asian carp and whether it tracks something like that.
Sure, John, thanks for your question. Fortunately, we have not encountered Asian carp in the open lake environment. My understanding is that there is a very small population of Asian carp that have established in the St. Joe's River, which is on the southeastern side of Lake Michigan. There's a very robust monitoring and response network that's been put in place with leadership from the Fish and Wildlife Service and Army Corps of Engineers. Fortunately, we're not seeing Asian carp in our large lake data, and you know, hopefully it remains that way.
Oh, that's great news. We only have a few seconds left, Peter. What are you watching for as this data collection continues?
We're really watching for ideal weather windows to get these our traditional crewed vessels out there with these sail drones, so that we can get the best possible comparative data. Data really is what drives our work, and it's what drives the best decision making. And so that's really what we're pushing for here, and that's why we're adopting these new technologies.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Esselman, research fishery biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, lead scientist on this 3-year study of fish populations in the Great Lakes. Just ahead, we talk with an expert on making end-of-life plans. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.